Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
It used to be seen as a costly and risky challenge, but sustainability has now become a business imperative.
Not having the data is no longer an excuse.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our second episode is all about moving from intention to action on sustainability. Episode 2 of Resilient Edge is coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm Krupa Patti. Thank you for being with us. We begin this hour in Lebanon, where it's been another unsettling night in the capital, Beirut, with the sounds of Israeli drones buzzing overhead. It comes after Friday's strike by the Israeli Defense Forces targeting Hezbollah's elite Radwan unit, killing several senior figures, including top military commanders Ibrahim Akil and Ahmed Wabi. At least 31 people, including 3 children, were killed. And this follows device explosions across Lebanon on Tuesday and Wednesday, killing dozens and wounding thousands more. Israel is widely believed to have been behind those attacks, but has made no comment. The cross-border fighting between Israel and Hezbollah escalated on the 8th of October last year, the day after the attack on Israel by Hamas gunmen from Gaza. Hezbollah thereafter fired at Israeli positions in solidarity with the Palestinians. Our correspondent Hugo Bashega is in Beirut for us. Good to have you with us, Hugo.
Hi there.
Hi. Since this morning, people have been waiting at the scene of yesterday's Israeli airstrike. I imagine they're there waiting for news of their loved ones. What can you tell us about the latest on those casualty figures?
Yes, yeah, so the Lebanese health ministry is saying that at least 31 people were killed, including 3 children and 7 women. And I was in Tahrir earlier today near the site of the attack. This is a densely populated district of Beirut, Hezbollah's stronghold in southern Beirut. And the attack happened late in the afternoon yesterday. So those streets in Tahrir were packed with people. And this morning there was still intense activity of emergency services. The search continued for people who were believed to be under the rubble. At least one building collapsed after that Israeli airstrike, and a lot of people were there, Hezbollah supporters, members, and there was still a lot of tension in the air, but people were still incredulous that their neighborhood, Hezbollah stronghold, had been hit.
For almost a year now, Hezbollah has fought this low-level conflict with Israel. What is the feeling now about what their next move might be, considering their significant losses this week, but equally what Iran, which backs Hezbollah, might do?
Yeah, so Hezbollah is in a very difficult position right now. The attack yesterday is a major escalation by Israel. It is a humiliation for Hezbollah. They lost 13 senior members, including 2 top military commanders. Their stronghold here in Beirut was hit. And obviously this came just days after those explosions targeting pagers, walkie-talkies used by the group. So a major breach, security breach by Hezbollah. So they need to be seen as responding to these attacks. But I think at the same time, they don't have many options to give a significant response without sparking a major war with Israel. And they have indicated repeatedly that they don't want a major war with Israel. And as you said, obviously, Hezbollah is supported by Iran. It is vital for Iran to have a strong Hezbollah here in Lebanon, right next to Israel. This is part of Iran's deterrence against any possible attack by Israel. So it is a very complicated situation for Hezbollah. And, this is a group that wants to be seen as a powerful, sophisticated enemy by Israel, and now has suffered a number of very serious setbacks.
It's fair to say, I imagine, that there's now a new level of fear amongst civilians in Lebanon.
Yeah, and I mean, when we talk to people here in Beirut, I think, you know, most people tell us that they are shocked by what happened, especially during those attacks when walkie-talkies and pagers exploded, because they say that everything is possible now. And, you know, there is the concern that more attacks like that could happen. One of our producers received a message from a friend who said she was, changing her Lebanese SIM card in her phone to an international one because she was concerned that her phone might explode. So I think this gives you a sense of the feeling here. And obviously there is the fear that this could be just the beginning of a wider Israeli offensive against Hezbollah. We've had a number of Israeli officials in recent days saying that there is a new phase in this conflict against Hezbollah. So there is the concern that we could be seeing an escalation of hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah that could affect not only people in the south of the country, but people across Lebanon.
Hugo Bashega for us in Beirut. Thank you for your time. Staying with this story, the UN Security Council met in New York yesterday to discuss the crisis in the Middle East after 4 days of those intensive Israeli attacks on Hezbollah. The organization's human rights chief, Volker Turk, said he was appalled by the use of indiscriminate targeting of thousands of people in Lebanon through the explosion of communication devices.
International humanitarian law prohibits the use of booby trap devices in the form of apparently harmless portable objects, which are specifically designed and constructed to contain explosive material. It is a war crime to commit violence intended to spread terror among civilians. I call again for an independent, thorough, and transparent investigation into the circumstances of these explosions. Those who ordered and carried out these attacks must be held to account.
The UN Secretary General's spokesman, Stefan Dujarric, also expressed concern about the escalation and called for restraint from all sides. Meanwhile, Israel's ambassador to the UN, Danny Danon, said Israel would continue to take action that it felt necessary to defend Israelis.
While Israel is not seeking a wider conflict, I will be clear. We will not allow Hezbollah to continue its provocations. Their actions violate international law. And Israel will defend itself. We will not allow our people to live under constant threat, nor will we allow Hezbollah to use Lebanese territory as a launchpad for violence.
Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Firaz Abiad, the Minister of Health for Lebanon. Thank you for your time, Dr. Abiad. Before we talk about the situation on the ground, can you give us your reaction to what was said there at the UN Security Council last night?
Well, I fully agree with the comments made by the humanitarian head at the UN, because this is indeed an indiscriminate attack. And we have seen a lot of civilians being involved. In the yesterday's attack, we're reporting 7 women and 3 children. In the attacks before, we had 2 children who also suffered, an 8-year-old girl and an 11-year-old boy. So clearly, unfortunately, civilians are caught in the middle of this.
So if it is your position that the pager and walkie-talkie attacks broke international law, and obviously we've had the strike yesterday separately, what action do you want to see next from the international community, if any?
I think that there has to be more pressures on everybody so that we can reach what from day one Lebanon has said. The Lebanese government has from day one said Lebanon does not want war, and we called for a ceasefire from Gaza to Lebanon. And I think that it's clearly now, after almost 1 year of conflict, that there is no visible solution to this this conflict as it is. And unfortunately, all these attacks, especially involving civilians and causing life-changing injuries, will only increase the indignation and the anger amongst the population.
Looking on the social media platform X, we've just posted on our BBC Live page that the Israeli Defense Forces are saying it is now attacking Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. Whilst you are calling for restraint and you do not wish for an escalation, that is not necessarily the position of the Israeli Defense Forces. What options do you have in light of that?
Well, at the moment, you are correct that we are receiving reports of a barrage of attacks in the south. And as I said, I think that Lebanon has been quite vocal in its position that we do not want war. However, as a health minister, I have to prepare for the worst. And this is what we have been doing with our health system.
Turning to the strike in the Beirut residential area on Friday, in a video statement, the IDF spokesperson Daniel Hagari said the Hezbollah individuals had, I quote, gathered underground under a residential building in Dahiya and used Lebanese civilians as, I quote, human shields. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that there are several principles in international humanitarian law calling for whether there was adequate distinction, whether there was adequate precaution in targeting civilians or not. And I'm not a specialist in IHL, but it's clear that when you kill innocent women and children and civilians to reach your target, this is something clearly a violation of the international humanitarian law, as was the use of these detonated communication devices, which unfortunately went off in markets, in streets, in hospitals. And we had almost these 3,000 casualties that presented to our hospitals.
Well, thank you very much for your time there. That is Dr. Firaz Abiyad, the Minister of Health for Lebanon, giving us an update on the position there in Lebanon. And as we were hearing, the Israeli military said it killed the senior Hezbollah commander, Ibrahim Akil. Analysts say he was certainly important within the militant group, described variously as a member of Hezbollah's governing Jihad Council and the acting head of the group's elite Radwan unit, and with a long history of striking not just Israeli but US targets as well. NewsHour's Julian Marshall spoke to Firaz Maqsad, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington, and he asked him how significant a figure Ibrahim Akil was.
The Radwan forces are obviously the special operation forces, pretty much the elite fighting force of Hezbollah. And Akil was not only the commander of that, but reportedly after Israel's assassination of Hezbollah's chief of staff back in July 30th, Akil had also taken on that role. So from late-breaking reports, this is quite a significant hit, particularly that there are some indications that not only was he killed alone, but with the entire command of that special operations unit within Hezbollah. These are the elite fighting force of Hezbollah, sort of the equivalent of the Marines, so to speak, in the United States. Within them is the anti-tank fighting brigades that are deployed in the south, very effective in terms of their firing on Israeli settlements. And so this is the creme de la creme of Hezbollah's fighting force, and it's a pretty embarrassing and devastating blow. Akil is wanted by the U.S. He had been there from day one in terms of Hezbollah's formation back when it was called the Islamic Jihad, really the early days of Hezbollah. He was involved in planning and in carrying out those attacks against the Marine barracks in Beirut. Some 230, 240 Marines are believed to have lost their lives as a result of that operation. And it led, I must say, to an eventual withdrawal of the multinational force, which the U.S. and France had been spearheading to try and bring the Lebanese civil war to some kind of a close.
Firaz Maqsad there, speaking to NewsHour's Julian Marshall. He's from the Middle East Institute in Washington. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up, a story which is all too common, yet all too terrible for so many people. Watching a loved one gradually succumb to Alzheimer's disease.
We were on holiday and she sort of leant in towards me and she said to me, "Now tell me, when did we first meet?" I really thought that she was joking. I think I laughed. And it was clear that she wasn't joking. And she was a little embarrassed then. And when I said, "I'm your daughter," "Oh, yes, yes, of course you are."
More on that later. Meanwhile, the headlines here in our newsroom. The Lebanese authorities say more than 30 people are now known to have died in an Israeli airstrike in Beirut that killed a top Hezbollah commander. And Russia has moved 1,200 people from their homes in the Krasnodar region following a Ukrainian drone attack on an ammunition warehouse. This is Krupa Bhatti with NewsHour live from London's new broadcasting house. To France now, where last week Dominique Pélicaud, the 71-year-old man accused of drugging his wife Gisèle Pélicaud unconscious and recruiting dozens of men to rape her over nearly a decade, admitted to all the charges against him. Meanwhile, only 15 of the 50 co-defendants accused of raping his now ex-wife have admitted guilt, with most saying that they believed that the sex was consensual. The trial has triggered a conversation in France about the challenges faced by victims of sexual violence, with women and campaigners taking to the streets. Karen Noblinsky is a criminal lawyer in Paris. First of all, I asked her what the definition of rape is under French law.
The law states that any act of sexual penetration of any kind whatsoever with threat, surprise or violence is rape.
And that should be quite clear. But when it comes to prosecutions, there are concerns because in recent days, in reaction to this case, we've seen protests in many French cities led by women and campaigners who believe that much violence remains unpunished. Can you outline that situation for us? How many cases end up in court in France?
A lot of cases end up in court, but a very hard subject here is the term of consent. The term of consent is not written under the law. We already talk a lot about consent when you are in a trial, but the term is not written in the law. So this trial perhaps make it possible to complete our law with the notion of consent. The Mazan trial will make judicial history, but it will also raise awareness among the general public because too often, too many have looked the other way. And this trial also allows us to rewrite the stereotype of rape. It's a public trial, a trial for the future, a trial to say loud and clear what chemical submission is, what is an unconscious body. A trial should be realistic about marital rape and about consent.
With regards to the definition of rape, do you believe that the failure to mention consent is the main challenge here?
When consent is written in the law, it will be, yes, a change and something important, but it's not for the moment. The most important thing, the bigger problem is to obtain clear proof of the act of sexual violence, because all cases of sexual violence takes place behind closed door and out of sight. Mazan case is one of a kind case because it's pretty rare to have videos and photo of those actions. So of course the term of consent is quite important, but it's not all.
Is there anything else you want to see added to the law?
No, you know, I don't see something else than consent written into the law. I think that it's not so much the way the law is written, but rather the fact that many cases are dismissed today because there is no sufficient proof. So it's the whole process who has to be improved and has to get more resource, more police officer to take complaint, more judge to study those cases. It's the whole thing, not especially the way the law is written. But yes, it will be a big day when the consent will be into the law.
The thoughts there of Karen Noblinsky, a criminal lawyer in Paris. After months of political uncertainty in France, the country is finally about to have a proper government this weekend. The country has been in turmoil since President Emmanuel Macron called a shock election this summer, which ended in a deadlocked parliament. He appears to have emerged badly, weakened from the whole business. Our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding has this assessment of France's leader.
Remember when Emmanuel Macron first took France by storm, sweeping to power as president here in Paris back in 2017, at the age of 39?
Je ferai tout pour qu'il n'ait plus aucune raison de voter pour les extrêmes.
At the time, and consistently ever since, Macron has articulated one overarching goal.
Pour faire barrage à celle de l'extrême droite.
Par les extrêmes et en particulier l'extrême droite.
to stop the extremes, the far right in particular, from ever getting close to power in France. So, how's that going? For the longest time, Macron seemed to have the magic touch, steering France through crises like the Yellow Vest protests. Then declaring war against COVID.
Nous sommes en guerre.
Macron was a smooth-talking moderate who could also, as the political analyst Florence Foscher-King notes, satisfy a certain French yearning for an almost king-like leader.
He's very affable, he's very sharp and clever, an eloquent speaker. So he likes phrases.
He likes the sound of his own voice, is what you're trying to say, perhaps politely.
Maybe. His idea is that French people, for some reason, need the authority of a kind of republican monarch, and that's what he's trying to embody.
But playing king is a risky strategy in France, and before long, Macron's increasingly regal style began to grate. Former Macronist ministers like Jean-Michel Blanquer saw power going to the president's head.
When you have, during a long time, the power, you have the temptation to concentrate. And it happened to Macron. Something has been lost. What has been lost is not about the content of his policies. It's much about the style of government, the methods.
He's lost his touch.
Yes, we can say that.
Then came this summer's parliamentary elections.
Je dissous donc ce soir l'Assemblée nationale.
Macron called them unexpectedly, hoping to strengthen his hand, warning about the usual dangers.
La montée des nationalistes, des démagogues, est un danger pour notre nation.
But French voters shrugged and veered sharply away from Macron. Many went to the left and far left, but the biggest single winner was the far-right, anti-immigrant party of Marine Le Pen. Her national rally became the largest in the country. In the southern market town of Carpentras, contempt for Macron seems almost universal.
When I say President Macron, he should leave.
Ah oui, c'est un charlot.
He's a joke.
And the national rally is now firmly established here, as in much of rural France. The local MP, Catherine Ambert, confident that the nation's next president will be Marine Le Pen. Her party, she points out, is growing exponentially. Voters are keen for us to seize power, she says. They can hardly wait. Meanwhile, on the left, the mood is one of pure frustration. This is an annual festival for left-wing voices in Paris. People here point out that their broad coalition actually came first in this summer's elections, but Macron has simply ignored the fact.
I think Macron really misled us for a very, very long time.
I feel like we were betrayed.
That feels like, I mean, I can throw my electoral card away, you know.
So where is all this leading? A far-right president? Violent protests? A new constitutional order? As in so much of Europe, populism, high prices and concerns about immigration are pushing French voters towards the right. There is still space to rebuild a winning majority in the centre ground. But Emmanuel Macron, his glory years now behind him, will surely struggle.
Andrew Harding reporting from Paris here. You're listening to NewsHour.
In the face of unprecedented disruption, it's become non-negotiable.
Companies are moving to what they call anti-fragile status.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. Our third episode is about supply chain resiliency and what it takes for organizations to minimize their risk and improve efficiency. So watch out for episode 3 of Resilient Edge, coming soon wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Krupa Bhatti. Sri Lankans are voting for a new president in the first election since mass protests sparked by the country's worst ever economic crisis unseated the leader back in 2022. The vote is widely regarded and Sorry, I'm going to take you back and we're going to actually bring you a account from Anna Holligan, 80 years almost after almost 2,000 paratroopers from the Allied 4th Parachute Brigade were launched into a failed mission to free the Netherlands from Nazi occupation. Today, their contemporary counterparts have been marking the anniversary of Operation Market Garded with a dramatic airborne display in the Dutch town of Edda, featuring 700 paratroopers from 8 NATO states. Our correspondent Anna Holligan has been finding out why the Dutch place such great emphasis on the memory of a battle that ended in an Allied defeat.
Why is it that the Dutch continue to mark this with such enthusiasm?
I think it's important to commemorate the past, to learn from it, especially with everything going on in the world and also in the Netherlands. So I think it's important to realize what it's like to be at war and how important it is to be at peace. You walk in a region where people fought, so you're there in the history, and the people that are still alive, some of them are here today, so you can say thank you to them, and it makes it very concrete. Now that the veterans, the people that can tell the stories, have died or are dying, we pass it on to another generation, their values and why it's important to stand up for freedom.
Were you very conscious of this when you were growing up?
I was once every year when we laid the flowers at a cemetery. When I was a little kid, it was very important, and my parents took me to the museum here.
For your sons, they're the ones who will take these stories on. Yeah. Is that important to you? Your sons are 8 and 5.
Almost 6. No, it is. It is. We have to tell them about what happened to remember, and also for them to learn that wars take place all over the world. And our safety is not something that you get for free.
So he was your adopted,
adopted
English
granddad.
Grandpa.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happened to him?
He was like in the trench over there with the Bren gun. And at the time, they were coming through tanks and they fired at him. And a mortar or a tank shell ricochet, piece of big shrapnel entered his belly and came out of his butt. So he was very badly wounded. He crawled over the street, knocked on the door. From let me in, help me. But the baker couldn't understand English. She smacked the door behind him again.
She thought it was a German.
And there were two nurses in the cellar as well. And they say, hey, that's an English guy.
And the shrapnel is now in the museum.
Yeah, the shrapnel, and together with his beret, is inside of the museum.
This is NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Krupa Bhatti. To Sri Lanka now, where people there have been voting for a new president in the first election since mass protests sparked by the country's worst ever economic crisis unseated the leader back in 2022. The vote is widely regarded as a referendum on economic reforms meant to put the country on the road to recovery. Well, let's get the thoughts now of our South Asia correspondent, Samira Hussain, who is there for us. Samira, what's been playing on the minds of voters?
Well, actually, I'm standing right now just across from the field and the roads where we saw protesters that had just occupied this entire area 2 years ago. Those angry scenes that we remember of, you know, pictures of people sort of leaping into the presidential pool and looting the presidential palace at the time. And even today, so fast forward to right now, the economy remains front and center on the minds of voters here. Because of the austerity measures that have had to be put in place, because of the billions of dollars in loans that the country has taken, well, it means that taxes are much higher. And it's become so much more expensive for people to pay for everyday goods. I was just speaking to a mom of two who was saying just everything is expensive, from a new car to petrol to basics like food. And that's what she wants to see changed, a lowering of the taxes.
So the economy very much at the forefront there. How's the day been?
The day's been pretty good. You know, we spent the day actually at a polling station in Colombo, in the capital. And there was a steady stream of voters coming in to cast their ballot. You know, this is the first election since that economic crisis. And so there's a lot of importance that was placed on these elections. Now, we're just getting voter turnout numbers from an election monitoring body, the People's Action for Free and Fair Elections. And they say that these elections, we saw that voter turnout was about 75% to 80%. And while that sounds high, especially for Western standards in an election, it's actually lower than the 83% voter turnout that we saw in 2019.
And why might that be?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think part of it could be voter apathy. You know, a sense that, you know, the situation is so difficult right now that there's really no leader that can do anything about it. And then I would assume that there's also some part of political apathy at play. For so long, Sri Lankans have been looking for leaders. You know, corruption has been an issue that a lot of people have been speaking to me about. And because there has been such a history of corruption within parliamentarians and within government, I think there's some disillusionment with the entire political process.
And Samira, there are 38 candidates, so a lot of choice.
A lot of choice, and that's going to actually make the counting all that much more difficult. So basically, once now that they've started to count votes, they're going to look at everyone's first choice. And if there's no clear winner after that first choice, if there's no one who gets 51, or rather 50.001% of the vote, then they're going to go to people's second and third choices. And so that's why many are expecting that, you know, compared to previous elections, we're going to get those numbers a little bit later than usual. Okay. And if they still don't have a clear majority after all of that, they flip a coin.
Oh, wow. Samira Hussain, no doubt you will keep us posted. Thank you for joining us here on NewsHour. On Sunday, voters in the eastern German state of Brandenburg go to the polls in a key regional elections. The anti-migrant far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD, could win the most votes. On the 1st of September, the AfD won a major election for the first time, coming first in the eastern German state of Thuringia. To undermine support for the far-right, the German government is now increasing deportations of rejected asylum seekers and has introduced checks on all German borders. The conservative opposition, meanwhile, wants borders closed to asylum seekers altogether. It's all a very different picture to a decade ago when the then Chancellor Angela Merkel allowed in 1.5 million refugees and migrants. Many of those people who arrived in 2015 are now becoming German citizens. But how do the new Germans feel about the increasingly hostile debate around migration? Damian McGuinness has been finding out.
So we are in Smetanastraße 31, in front of the school gym hall where I used to live for 6 months.
In 2015, Parveen spent months travelling, mostly on foot, from Afghanistan to Europe with her three-year-old son and her disabled nephew. They were shot at by border guards, and Parveen feared for her life in the Mediterranean when the overcrowded rubber dinghy they were in, crossing from Turkey to Greece, started sinking.
Somehow you got to forget the person you are and how you were living in your country like a human being. That was breaking me down. Life has changed a lot. Recently, I received my citizenship.
The image I remember most from 2015 is Munich train station, where many refugees arrived in Germany for the first time.
But what became known then as the welcome culture is today hard to find.
Three people were killed, eight more suffered severe knife wounds after a man attacked people, apparently at random.
Germany is in a political meltdown over migration, in part because of the fallout of a brutal stabbing in the town of Solingen in August.
He was a Syrian asylum seeker.
They say he is a member of the Islamic State group.
The attack has only played into the hands of those who wish to connect refugees and migrants with crime and terror.
Right now, everything is coming to a head. And now is the opportunity to say we're incredibly afraid and we know we are being threatened.
Sultana came to Germany a decade ago from Afghanistan when she was just 10 years old. Today, she's about to go to law school, but she's still waiting for her German citizenship. I met her in the eastern state of Thuringia as she was planning a protest against the far-right AfD party, which has just won the most votes in the regional election here.
But you have to understand that this has been the reality for years.
Hi, Damian. We are here in the United Kingdom.
Meanwhile, Parveen, with her new German passport, has been able to visit her sister in London for the first time.
I found London really different than Berlin. I even cried for a couple of times, like, seeing people being so nice to each other.
She's also just qualified as a social worker and is now thinking about moving to the UK because she doesn't feel welcome in Germany anymore. According to one study, a quarter of people with a migrant heritage in Germany are also thinking about leaving, and 10% have concrete plans to emigrate. Sultana, though, is staying, and her anti-racism demo drew huge crowds. Her answer to the far right is not to leave, but to get more politically active.
We have no choice. Many of the migrants have no citizenship and so have no right to vote. But we have voices and we want to take these voices out onto the streets and say, we are here and we are staying here. And we will keep fighting and we will not let our rights be taken away.
Wir lassen uns hier unsere Rechte auch nicht nehmen.
And that was Damian McGuinness reporting for us. The game of chess has long been associated with Russia, but like in many other sports, the war in Ukraine has led to Russian teams and players being banned from international competitions. Now, the International Chess Federation, whose president is a former deputy prime minister of Russia, is due to hold a vote this weekend at a meeting in Budapest that could lift all sanctions against Moscow. Ukraine and its allies are mounting a campaign to stop that from happening. Our correspondent Will Vernon reports.
The sixth game of this fascinating chess match, the battle for the world championship between the Grand Master of the East and the West.
Reykjavik, 1972. It's the height of the Cold War, when communism and capitalism squared up on the world stage. A battle was about to take place at the World Chess Championship.
The Soviet team appeared to be taken off balance.
As the whole world looked on, American Bobby Fischer beats Soviet chess grandmaster Boris Spassky. Moscow was furious. In the early days of the USSR, Vladimir Lenin championed the game of chess. Its cunning logic reflected Soviet strength. What the country lacked in technology and economic vitality, they made up for in intellectual superiority over the West. But the man tasked with rolling out chess clubs in Soviet towns, Nikolai Krylyanka, clearly made a wrong move, as he was later executed by Joseph Stalin. The culture of chess has long been associated with military strategy. Cold War nuclear brinkmanship was often described as being like a chessboard. In Moscow, the KGB kept a very close eye on Soviet chess players. Embarrassingly, some of them defected to the West. When the Soviet Union fell apart, Russia lost many of its great players and its dominance in the game. But now, the Kremlin is fighting back. Moscow is once again dedicating political energy and screen time to chess. And the war in Ukraine is spilling over onto the chessboard. 2 years ago, the International Chess Federation, known as FIDE, voted to ban the Russian national team and officials from all competitions. But this weekend, a crucial vote will be held at FIDE that could fully reinstate Russia. FIDE delegates have told the BBC that Russia's control of the federation is absolute. They say Moscow has made changes to its constitution, affecting the way decisions are made, And Russia has many delegations on its side from Asia and Africa. Some say bribery takes place, which Moscow denies. But the Ukrainian Chess Federation, supported by Western allies, is trying to prevent Russia's return. President Zelensky has given one of his best men the job of stopping Russia. Alexander Kamyshin made his name as the superstar boss of Ukrainian railways. Now, he's been tasked with derailing Russia's attempts to reinsert itself into international chess. While the chess world might seem a rather insignificant geopolitical arena for some, for the Kremlin, it's crucial. Vladimir Putin said that chess was vital for Soviet survival during World War II. The game is central to Russian prestige and historical identity. And Moscow will be hoping that a successful result this weekend can be a springboard for Russia's exoneration across the board, in sport, trade and international relations. A victory at the Chess Federation today could lead to checkmate against the West tomorrow.
And that was Will Vernon reporting. You're listening to NewsHour. This is Krupa Party with NewsHour live here on the BBC World Service. Today is World Alzheimer's Day, the most common cause of dementia, which is a gradual decline in brain functioning. It can impact memory, thinking skills and other mental abilities. Over 55 million people worldwide live with dementia, the majority of whom live in low and middle income countries. I've been talking to the journalist and science writer, Anthea Rowan, who has written a book, A Silent Tsunami, Swimming Against the Tide of My Mother's Dementia. She took me back to the moment her mother forgot she was her daughter.
We were on holiday and one evening I asked if she'd like a drink. Yes, she'd like a drink. I fetched her a cold beer. We sat down and she sort of leant in towards me and she said to me, "Now tell me, when did we first meet?" I really thought that she was joking. I think I laughed. And it was clear that she wasn't joking. And she was a little embarrassed then. And when I said, "I'm your daughter," "Oh, yes, yes, of course you are." But the next morning, she'd obviously been fretting about this all night. And the next morning, she flatly and furiously refused that I was her daughter and said that I must be lying and I looked too old to be her daughter. I collected photographs on my laptop as a sort of PowerPoint who's who to try to prove I was her daughter, and lending context to that argument that I was her daughter. But she continued to attest that I wasn't her daughter, to the point where I heard her checking with people on the phone. "I hear that Anthea is my daughter. You know, I wish somebody had told me." So it wasn't just the forgetting, but it was this completely skewed logic.
That's a lot to process.
It was. And my eldest daughter said to me, "How does it make you feel?" But I wasn't really able to articulate how it made me feel. I felt very, very shocked. I felt very confused. I really felt at sea. Mm. I didn't know what to feel.
But you knew she had memory loss. So was it that you weren't anticipating this moment?
I didn't know that her memory loss was anything like that. She had had a stroke a few years previously. And the doctors at the time said to us, "There may be some transient memory loss." I have since discovered that a stroke can cause dementia, and quite quickly after it, in somebody who's elderly. So I sort of blamed it on the stroke. I blamed it on the fact that she was elderly. I blamed it on senior moments. I think it was just denial. Denial and a total lack of education about dementia. Mm,
which is so important. And you also write about how you felt alienated, but that was very different to your mother's relationship with your sister.
Yes.
And your granddaughter.
Yes, yes, yeah. She knew all of them. She didn't want me. I had been dispensing all her medications and helping her to bed every evening. She didn't want me to do that anymore. She closed the door and said, no, my sister Carol will help me. My daughter Carol will help me." I didn't feel angry or resentful that at anybody else that she did remember. I just shocked and quite numb. I mean, you never, ever expect that a parent will forget you. Yeah. And yet I find it is incredibly common in dementia. How that forgetting happens, I think, is different in every case.
And Anthea, you were very honest with your mum about her condition. And I wonder how that played into the dynamic between the two of you.
I was Honest to a point, I only ever used the word dementia with her once, and it caused such distress, I never did it again. Because later on, she came to live with me, and she lived with me for 18 months before she died. And she would often complain, oh, my memory is so terrible. And I said to her, oh, Mum, you know, you're old, or we all forget for things. I tried to minimise it for her because she knew what that word meant, dementia, and I wasn't going to use it again.
You also write that forgetting is just the beginning.
Yes, forgetting is just the beginning of dementia. And once I had lived with the condition for some months, quite frankly, it's the least of it. It was the least of it in my case. In the end, it didn't matter that she had forgotten who I was. I didn't mind that. Towards the end, I hated that she lost her sense of taste. That was one of the last things she was able to enjoy was food. So it was one of the last things as her carer that I could make a bit of a fuss over her at meals, prepare things for her that I knew she really enjoyed. Her life was so small by then that if she could have one meal that she really enjoyed and really relished, I made it worth it. But when she couldn't taste, I really hated that. And I hated her hallucinations and paranoia. They brought such fear to her. When they began, when her hallucinations began, they didn't appear to be frightening. She would ask, who are those children in the garden? And there was nobody in the garden. And we quickly learnt to say, oh, they're probably just the neighbour's children, or, oh, we know them, it's fine, Mum. Or she would say, who's the man with the children in the garden? My husband was very good at this, and he would say, that's their dad, isn't he great the way he plays with them? And he'd sort of buy into the fiction. But then her hallucinations took on a really terrifying dimension, and they turned into men with weapons and armies, and she would hear voices in the ceiling. And I found that very difficult because it's very hard to comfort or placate. And all the books tell you to distract somebody with dementia. But I'm not sure how you do that when she couldn't walk easily by then. She couldn't read. She couldn't follow a television programme. And she couldn't remember.
Considering you empowered yourself with as much knowledge as you could at the time, why do you talk about feeling guilty in the end?
I think that I felt guilty in the end as a carer. And I think having talked to other carers, having read about other carers, I think it's a fairly universal thing amongst carers. Because as particularly with dementia, it's so difficult for your charge, the person you're looking after, to articulate precisely what they need. So you often feel as if you're falling short. And it's difficult to spend time with them. Because if you have a mother who has forgotten all of your history, where's the foundation for a conversation?
When you spoke to your mum about her condition, how did she describe it?
I was determined to approach mum's dementia with curiosity, probably as a consequence of being a science journalist, but also just because I'm a curious person. So I used to ask her often, you know, while she was living with me, about things to understand why she was or wasn't doing things. Why didn't she like having a shower? I realised she didn't understand how to use the taps. I was worried maybe she'd scalded herself. Why didn't she like unloading the dishwasher anymore? And she said to me, I'm afraid to get it wrong. So I realised she doesn't like to get things wrong and she obviously doesn't know where things go now. But I'd never asked her what it was like to have dementia. She told me one day, apropos of absolutely nothing, I feel as if I'm in prison. And I thought, yeah, because her life is so foreshortened.
Anthea Rowan there on her new book, A Silent Tsunami, Swimming Against the Tide of My Mother's Dementia. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. Thank you for your company and do stay with the BBC World Service.
NewsHour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.
In the face of unprecedented disruption, it's become non-negotiable.
Companies are moving to what they call anti-fragile status.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC StoryWorks Commercial Productions. Our third episode is about supply chain resiliency and what it takes for organizations to minimize their risk and improve efficiency So watch out for episode 3 of Resilient Edge, coming soon wherever you get your podcasts.